I'm Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast here at WNYC, in today for Leonard Lopate. Leonard will be back on Monday. Chinese food has been hugely popular in the U.S. for decades, but when certain Americans began to complain of headaches, dizziness, and tightness in the chest after eating it, researchers blamed one particular ingredient, monosodium glutamate, better known as MSG. But newer research has cast doubt on whether MSG was really to blame, and some chefs are pushing to bring it back. Here to help us better understand this ingredient is Ed Schoenfeld, the owner and operator of Red Farm, Zagat's top-rated Chinese restaurant in New York, and an authority on Chinese cuisine, even though he looks kind of like a Jewish Santa Claus. Welcome, Ed.
Hey, how are you?
I'm sure you get that a lot.
I do, especially when I'm dressed in red. I'm in purple.
Yeah. We're also joined on the phone by Dr. Ian Mosby. He's a food historian and postdoctoral fellow at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. Ed and Ian, thanks for joining us on today's Please Explain.
Glad to be here.
And if you have a question or comment about MSG, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. Do you feel that it makes you sick, or do you, perhaps on the other side of the coin, do you like to cook with MSG and encourage people to use it? 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. Ian, I'd like to start with you and just lay out some basic facts. What is MSG?
Well, MSG is the sodium salt of the naturally occurring amino acid glutamate, and it was discovered in the early 20th century by a Japanese biochemist named Kikune Akita, and it's, you know, right now it's one of the most commonly used food additives, and it's pretty ubiquitous in North America.
And does it... I know that glutamate occurs naturally. Does monosodium glutamate occur naturally in things, in foods and animals?
No, monosodium glutamate is sort of a stable... Glutamate is stabilized using ordinary salt through an industrial process. But glutamate itself is relatively common, and there's certain foods that are particularly high in glutamate, like Parmesan cheese, mushrooms, soy sauce, things like that.
So those foods have a lot of naturally occurring glutamate in them, and monosodium glutamate is glutamate that essentially has been processed to make it stable enough to add it to all different foods. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And well, you know, we'll get more into this, but just so we can get this right out of the way here, what does the latest research say about MSG's effect on people who eat it? Is there evidence of some kind of allergy or sensitivity?
There is some evidence that some people are sensitive to MSG, but compared to the you know, number of people who claim to have an MSG sensitivity, a lot of peer-reviewed studies recently have found it difficult to actually show levels of Chinese restaurant syndrome, which is reactions are often called, among people who claim to experience it.
Right. Like, I mean, my grandmother insisted back in the 70s, before anyone had heard of MSG, that whenever she ate Chinese food, she had this burning sensation in the back of her neck. So is there an explanation for what was happening to her if it wasn't the MSG?
Well, you know, one of the when I started doing the history of this, I personally don't have any reactions to MSG. And I started doing research on it because I was wondering why, you know, when I looked at Chinese restaurants, they often had on their menu or on their signs those giant no MSG signs, MSG with a cross through it. But then if I looked on the back of a bag of Doritos or something, you know, MSG is a significant ingredient in canned soup and all sorts of processed foods. And so I was wondering, you know, why is it that we're concerned about there being MSG in Chinese food, and why do people claim to react more to Chinese food when MSG is this ubiquitous ingredient? It's, you know, throughout our entire food chain.
So what you're saying is that people are eating MSG all the time and not realizing it and not having a reaction. They only seem to have the reaction when they have Chinese food, in at least some cases. Is that right?
Well, and it's, you know, people, you don't see no MSG signs on, you know, for instance, like McDonald's or Burger King or on Japanese restaurants or on Thai restaurants. It's usually Chinese restaurants. And one of the things I found in my research was a lot of this had to do with sort of pre-existing assumptions about Chinese cooking, Chinese restaurants.
Right, right. I want to get more into that in just a minute, but I want to bring Ed in here. Ed, I understand MSG is one of your favorite tools in the kitchen.
Well, I did make a joke when you asked me to come on the show and said it's one of my favorite toys. And actually, it used to be, And my so-called love affair with MSG has had some stages to it. And currently I cook with, for years I've been, I haven't had any MSG in my kitchen, where for years I did. And just recently, I bought my first MSG in quite a long time. I thought I'd play with it a little bit. But, you know, I certainly see that it's in many of the ingredients I use. And my restaurants, which feed over 5,000 people a week, we have no MSG in our kitchen, but we cook with soy sauce. And I think some of the soy sauces we use might possibly have a little MSG. Different brands are different. And you know, the whole discussion in terms of the Chinese restaurant industry about, oh, that's no good for you, you know, the request, can you make my food without MSG, it's really evaporated. These days, the question is, no gluten. What has gluten?
Right.
Right. And having been in the business for, you know, decades now, I went through a period where, you know, every guest would come in, you know, literally almost every table. Do you use MSG? And now the number of people who ask that question is less by 98%. It's extraordinary how the change has taken place. But the syndrome that you know, you guys were talking about is definitely, that's definitely where it's at. I mean, people have that presumption about
right.
it.
And when you stopped cooking with MSG, was that by your choice or because so many people kept asking you to cook without it?
You know, I've never cooked in the restaurant. I'm someone who's been cooking every day for 40 years in his home. So I was using the MSG only for my own personal consumption. And I'm a self-taught cook. I was lucky enough to learn from some really great Chinese chefs. And when you learn classic recipes from very fine, high-end chefs, MSG was often one of the components. And one of the noteworthy things in those recipes is that most of the recipes were permutations on the same set of ingredients. And so MSG was very often there, and there are a few cases like in a sweet and sour sauce where it's never there. And I just started playing with different salts and trying to get the same effect by using different ingredients. And of course, fundamentally, you know, it goes back to the quality of the ingredient you're dealing with in the first place. You know, how fresh is it? How flavorful is it? Where did it grow? What's its terroir? What variety is it?
Right. But what role does when you cook with MSG, what role does it play in the recipe? Like what does MSG bring to a dish that you can't get so easily elsewhere?
You know, it creates this little, it works a little like salt, but it kind of creates a savory flavor on your tongue. It makes things that have a fairly natural taste. Maybe they're on the bland side without MSG or very, very clean flavored. MSG just kicks it up a notch and it just gives it a touch more presence.
Right. I mean, it's I have a box of uncut MSG in my kitchen that I picked
up.
Uncut, huh? Uncut, yeah. It's the good stuff. I picked it up at an Asian market and it says on the box that it advertises the essence of umami.
Right.
So that's really a lot of what we're talking about here is that flavor, umami.
Right. And if you look at the Japanese kitchen, which is, you know, again, that's where, you know, this started, right? You know, it was discovered in the beginning of the 20th century by a Japanese chemist. I mean, they really isolated it by using a type of seaweed, which is the part of the basis of Japanese cooking, which is kombu seaweed. And any Japanese chef who's making a stock, making a dashi, they're going to use different grades of kombu seaweed to make a broth and then take that flavored water, that glutamate flavored water, and cook with it. And you know, some of the most intriguing things to me are little tricks that I see chefs using that glutamate flavor, that umami flavor, but taking it out of a natural source and then playing with it. I have some very funny uses that I've come across, or very clever ones, really, that I really, you know, think are just cool. One of my favorite ones is a great sushi chef I know who takes salt water and infuses it with kombu seaweed, puts it in a spray bottle, and he makes a platter of sashimi. And right before he hands it to you, it's like below the counter, he takes his little spray gun and he sprays it with this little spray of salt water flavored with kombu. And what a great trick.
Right. I mean,
really, you know, excellent.
I want that spray bottle.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I was at a famous sushi counter just a month or two ago in Hong Kong. And it was an omakase dinner. And one chef feeding 11 people, got to sit for the whole evening. No one else came, no second round of business. And he pulled out this package, and he was serving me some sashimi. And the package was actually two sheets of kombu seaweed, and sandwiched in between them were slices of sashimi. And he pulled those pieces of fish out and, you know, presented them to me. And I was like, oh, what a cool idea. It's actually on my list of things to play with sometime very soon.
Right, right. I'm Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast here at WNYC, in for Leonard Lopez today. I'm talking with Ed Schoenfeld, the man behind the restaurants Red Farm and Decoy, and I'm also joined by phone by food historian Ian Mosby, and we're talking about MSG this week on Please Explain. Let's take a call. Let's hear from Marion in the Bronx.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I actually had once a very, very bad reaction to MSG, where my the lower part of my face, like along my jawbone, just all of a sudden went completely numb, and it was after eating this meal. And first I thought I had lockjaw? I had no idea, right? And but then we chased it down, and my impression was is that there was a lot of MSG in this particular meal. And I was wondering if your guests thought it could be dose-related.
Okay, thanks for the call, Marion. Ian, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, was it at a Chinese restaurant where you experienced it?
Was it at a Chinese restaurant?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things about, you know, I can't totally speak to your experience. There is some evidence in some studies that it is dose-related, that it is about using too much MSG. One of the problems is it's very hard to define, you know, what that is. And one of the problems with the Chinese restaurant syndrome is, you know, a whole range of symptoms is associated with it, but usually it's anything unpleasant after eating at a Chinese restaurant. It's really difficult to reproduce those specific symptoms scientifically. So it's very hard to say whether it was necessarily MSG or if it was something else with the cooking. It's, you know, it's difficult, you know, to pin those things down scientifically.
And Ian, can you give us a little bit of the history of how this idea about MSG sort of gained prominence in the popular mindset?
Yeah, MSG had actually been, you know, introduced into the American food supply starting in the 1930s, but really in the 1940s. But it wasn't until 1968, and in a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine by a physician named Dr. Robert Homan Kwok, in which he described a syndrome, and he gave a number of symptoms, including numbness at the back of the neck, general weakness, and palpitation. And he described it as what he called the Chinese restaurant syndrome, and was asking the readers of the New England Journal of Medicine if they had any experience with this or if they knew what was causing it. And it sort of caused a flood of letters to the journal and significant media attention, especially from the New York Times. And so people started relating their own bad experiences in Chinese restaurants. But one thing that happened relatively quickly was, you know, much more than the initial symptoms he described started to be associated with this. And a lot of the early studies into what would actually become the medical condition, Chinese restaurant syndrome, you know, referred to in journals like Science and the New England Journal of Medicine as the Chinese restaurant syndrome, it started to be really associated with any symptoms, you know, after eating MSG or after eating in a Chinese restaurant.
Right. I know, Ian, there was a study done on rats about the effect of MSG consumption. Did that study suggest that at times MSG can be dangerous?
Well, there were sort of these two streams of studies that were going on. There were some studies that were of the effects of, you know, after eating, consuming orally MSG and its relationship with the Chinese restaurant syndrome. But there was another series of study by neurologist named John Olney, and he, instead of looking at how MSG affected you after you consumed it, he actually injected rats with sort of mega doses of MSG and found that, you know, there was a whole series of problems from brain damage to stunted offspring. This was a very different strain of research because it was suggesting that there was a long-term effect of MSG usage. And that research has been pretty thoroughly debunked since then. But these concerns about the Chinese restaurant syndrome, brain damage, they all started to sort of percolate in the late 60s and early 1970s.
I'm speaking with Ed Schoenfeld, the culinary mastermind behind the restaurants Red Farm and Decoy, and with food historian Ian Mosby. And we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit. I would love to hear if any Asian or Asian American listeners want to call in and talk about the role that MSG plays in your cooking at home and in your culture, because I know that Chef David Chang, for instance, has suggested that there is some degree of a cultural gap here, that people who are accustomed to growing up eating MSG eat it all the time and have no issue with it, and that perhaps there have been some suggestions that even there's a certain amount of racial mistrust, I guess I could say, in some quarters. And I'm curious to hear from our guests if they think that's a possibility, and I'd love to hear from callers who cook with MSG or use it in their homes about how you use it and what you think when you hear people calling in saying that it gives them such a negative reaction. So please give us a call, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. We'll hear more after a quick break. Welcome back to the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast here at WNYC. In for Leonard today. Leonard will be back on Monday. And we're talking about MSG, monosodium glutamate. I'm here with Ed Schoenfeld, the owner and operator of Red Farms, the GOT's top-rated Chinese restaurant in New York and an authority on Chinese cuisine. Thanks for still being here, Ed. And on the phone, we have Dr. Ian Mosby, food historian and postdoctoral fellow at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. And this is Please Explain. And Ian, I wanted to, you know, we're getting comments on the show page and a bunch of people calling in. Some people are suggesting that there's a difference between natural MSG and industrial MSG. Is there a difference, or is there no such thing as natural MSG?
Well, you know, MSG is the product, monosodium glutamate. It's you know, it's got glutamate attached to, salt. And so, but it's difficult to show in scientific studies, you know, how they react differently in the body, how naturally occurring glutamate interacts differently than MSG. And so to a certain extent, it's hard to prove that they actually work differently when in your body.
Right. Let's take a call from Yanir on Staten Island. Hi, Yanir. You're on WNYC.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Sure.
So I was just wondering, I'm a professor of chemical engineering, and so I'm thinking about sort of like the interactions MSG might have in Chinese food with other compounds that might be there inherently, whereas they wouldn't be in Japanese food or other types of food. Is that something that people have looked into? I'm not very versed in the literature.
Ian?
Not to the best of my knowledge. I don't think that's been a particular area of study. And actually, that was one of the things about the early studies of Chinese restaurant syndrome was it was really stuck to just the study of Chinese restaurants, and there was no even analysis of literatures outside of the United States, you know, whether it was in Japan, China, or elsewhere.
Let's take another call from Jim in Denville, New Jersey. Hi, Jim.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
My wife and I have noticed for years that they use the term natural flavors in ingredient lists for various canned and other prepared foods. We're under the impression that is in fact simply code for MSG. We're wondering if that's true.
Ian, do you know whether natural flavoring, when it says natural flavors on a label, can that mean MSG?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no.
Okay. It sounds like MSG, glutamate is natural. MSG is technically not natural in that you can't pick it off a plant. But it's not exactly, futuristic science. It's just salt added to glutamate, which is natural.
And glutamate that's produced through fermentation of various things, whether it's, wheat or corn, et cetera.
Okay. Okay, Ed, I want to talk a little bit more about the ways that you use MSG in your cooking. What are some ways that you might use it that people might be surprised to hear about?
Well, when I'm cooking, let's say a very clean vegetable, I for instance like to eat cabbage a great deal, and I might just saute some cabbage the way an Italian chef might, a little olive oil, a little garlic, a little salt, just a little pinch of MSG right there. It would be a real pick me up. It would, you know, it would just make it really tasty in a way that you're not quite aware of, but you might find yourself taking a bite of the cabbage and saying, oh boy, that tastes really good, and you're suddenly going back for more and a second bite and
right,
a third bite,
right.
Which to me is like, oh, when I see that behavior, I'm saying, oh, really tasty food. I, for instance, cook with a type of soy sauce. It's a brand called Healthy Boy Soy Sauce. It's made in Thailand by a Chinese company. They make different kinds. I love their mushroom soy. It's a very light soy. If you mixed it with rice and made fried rice, the rice would still look almost white. And it has a touch of MSG in it. I love putting hiding little bits of this soy sauce in my cooking. At this time of the year, I've been a fanatic about making fresh homemade tomato sauces, trying to use real Italian-style plum tomatoes, like a variety that has a little point on the bottom. They're very, very thick and jammy. Taking us, you know, just peeling them, pureeing them, cooking them down a little bit. And then I'm putting some salt, maybe a touch of sugar in that sauce. Very, very clean. And at the very last moment, I might put in a few drops of this soy sauce. You wouldn't know that it was there.
Yeah.
But then sauce some pasta with it and maybe add some Parmesan cheese and have a double umami thing
right.
going on.
Yeah, no,
and layering flavors like that is a way that it's very, very versatile and very effective. And actually, we use very, very small amounts of it. You know, in the Chinese kitchen, I'm almost certain that many chefs, especially Cantonese chefs, use chicken powder, you know, which is, you know, bouillon. Right. And clearly there's often a little MSG in there.
Right.
Right. And again, it's something that when you're trying to keep a clean, natural flavor, but you want to just amp it up a bit, that's where it's really effective.
Yeah. I've been getting really lately into Maggi sauce, which is huge in Asia and in Eastern and Central
right.
Europe and Latin America. They actually have slightly different recipes in different parts of the world.
Right. Swiss originally, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Right. But the Hong Kong version is probably the one that's purchased the most.
Right, right. But that's got MSG in it. It's got a little sugar. And my kids, I call it magic sauce instead of Maggi sauce.
Uh-huh.
And I put a couple of drops on their plate, and I'm like, kids, whatever you dip in this magic sauce will taste amazing. And they'll dip broccoli in there and eat it. They'll dip anything in there, and there's a little touch. And there's just something about that depth of flavor that you get with that sauce that's just so good.
Yeah, you know, I have a certain kind of skepticism when people say, well, the food's cooked with a ton of MSG. You know, MSG is something that even when someone's using it regularly, if they're a professional chef, they're using very, very small quantities. So, you know, maybe it is true that maybe it does bond or react with certain foods and not, you know, not other foods. So if you happen to put it in a dish that has peppers in it or a dish that has, you know, onions or something like that, maybe it reacts differently. I don't know the answer to that question, but just empirically, you know, it's something that I've always wondered about.
Right. Let's go to Michael in Medford, New York. Hi, Michael. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Lenny. How you doing? You know, as a Chinese American, I've used MSG very often, but not in its pure form. Usually it's in the form of some kind of Lee Kum Kee chicken bouillon powder, and just a little bit seems to go a long way. You know, in my food experimentation, as Ed had said earlier, I actually use it in vegetables to kick it up a little bit. And people often say, wow, this is delicious. What's in this bok choy? And I'm like, I can't tell you. It's a little bit of chicken bouillon, really. And that's it.
Right. Well, it's so funny you say that, Michael, because so my grandmother was always sure that MSG made her not feel well in Chinese restaurants. My mom, same thing. I remember going out as a family to Chinese restaurants in the 80s and 90s. She would always say no MSG, that she had a sensitivity. Just this past week, my parents were visiting, and I made a cauliflower soup, and I put in a little sprinkle of Maggi sauce and a little sprinkle of MSG.
Uh-huh.
Next morning, I said to my mom, You feel okay? How's the, you have that burning sensation in the back of your neck? She said, no, no, not at all. Why? Well, there was MSG in the cauliflower soup, you know. Now, that's anecdotal and unscientific, I will grant you, but I think it was interesting that she had that reaction. Let's take a call from Yan in North America. Hi, Yan.
Hi. I live in New York, Brooklyn, New York. I came from China years ago. I remember back in China, every kitchen has MSG just next to their oil and salt, like a regular ingredient. And the Chinese word for MSG is wei jing, means translate as the extremely concentrated flavor. So you don't put a lot, but just put a pinch when whatever you're cooking. And they said they would give you some meaty flavor, since at the time we were quite in China, meat was very hard to get. So they add MSG to bring out the meaty flavor. That's one way to use that. But here, I'm in U.S., I don't use MSG at all in my cooking. But we know Chinese restaurant, when you go to a Chinese restaurant, the only complaint I heard from Chinese who's eating Chinese MSG in the restaurant, the complaint is getting thirsty. When you eat MSG, you get thirsty. That's the only complaint. I've never heard of a headache or any other kind of complaint in China from Chinese who were eating MSG all the time.
Right. And I'm curious to hear. So when you hear people, when you hear Americans talking about MSG in this way, and so many of them go to Chinese restaurants and request food without MSG, what do you think of that? How does that make you feel?
I just see that's some kind of a myth. I don't think there should be any correlation between MSG and headache, because there are 1.3 billion Chinese. Nobody complained about that. Why so few people here complain about that?
Okay. Thank you very much for your call, Jan. Let's go to Michael in Huntington, Long Island. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how's it going? I just want to say how I use MSG all the time. I love it. I think it's fantastic, and it's indispensable in dishes like Shanghai fried rice, which is usually very simple flavors, maybe a little fried egg and some scallions, things like that. It's not like the American-style fried rice, and it really brings out the flavor in that. And for me, what it does is it activates a certain spot on my tongue that's kind of central and toward the tip, and it makes me salivate. And I think that could attribute to the increased thirst, maybe. But it's just something that I think you must have in the kitchen, and it's perfect for things like adding a little subtle deliciousness.
All right, thanks, Michael. Ed, you just gave a big thumbs up when Michael referenced that special spot on his tongue.
Yeah, I identify with that, and I also, you know, it's been in my mind to say, and someone said it for me, you know, one of the really good uses for it is like in the Chinese kitchen anyways, making fried rice or a sauteed noodle dish. It has that little je ne sais quoi, that little extra savory quality. And, you know, you can do that by using good salt, too. I mean, and tasting well, you
right.
know.
Ian, I want to turn back to you. You feel that there is that race is a component to this story. How so?
Well, I definitely think so. You know, the very fact that this reaction to MSG became actually called in the scientific literature Chinese restaurant syndrome, there was already this assumption that there was something specific about Chinese food that made you more likely to react. And I, you know, one of the things I found in my research was there was already a longstanding assumption that, you know, there's something inscrutable going on in Chinese kitchens, and you're more likely to get sick. You're more likely to be, you know, tricked by the chef to eating bad food, or, you know, there's these longstanding sort of tropes about, you know, when you're eating meat at a Chinese restaurant, it might be cats or dogs or rats. And so when the Chinese restaurant syndrome became, you know, publicized in the late 60s, early 70s, people latched onto it because they already believed that, you know, there's probably something wrong with the food that was being made. And this was built on longstanding assumptions about Chinese immigrants in particular.
Ed, you've certainly spent a lot of time traveling around Asia and are an expert in that culture. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I the thought that was going through my mind when our caller was speaking was that, you know, Chinese food, things are cut into small pieces, so it makes them very difficult to identify. So, you know, that's kind of like the lay of the land. You know, so the suspicion that, you know, somebody's sneaking something, you know, that should have been in the pet store rather than in the supermarket into the food, you know, I think it starts over there. But
doesn't it also feed into an existing narrative and stereotype that's been put on Asian people for some time, that there is somehow something furtive happening?
I think it does. And I also think that it, you know, the whole MSG discussion is kind of an extension of that. It makes it opens the door. It makes it easy to say, oh, it's MSG. And, you know, it is very significant to me now that there's so little of that discussion, certainly in my business. It's remarkable to me. I started in the industry in the 70s, and it was, you know, omnipresent complaining about MSG, and now so few people mention it. And I can't remember the last time someone came to me and said, you know, I felt sick because of this. I mean, not that we cook with it, but I go to many, many Chinese restaurants, and, you know, and I can identify it. I mean, I can see when something jumps a little more than it should, when it tastes a little more bok choy-ish than not, you know.
It's like a performance-enhancing spice.
You know, it has a good place. It works in other cooking, you know.
We just got a few seconds left. Tell me, each of you, real quick, as we wrap up at the end of the week, Ed, what are you cooking this weekend?
What am I cooking this weekend? Italian sausage.
Okay,
with
Ian.
Pasta.
All right, Ian, what are you cooking?
I'm making Dukobor borscht, which is a sort of a cream borscht.
All right. I've been speaking with Ed Schoenfeld, the culinary mastermind behind the restaurants Red Farm and Decoy, and with food historian Ian Mosby. Thanks so much to both of you for being on the show today.
Thanks so much. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.